And Representative Gray moves approval of the minutes from the third meeting of the redistricting committee of January 23rd. Any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Members, first an announcement. As we mentioned earlier this session, we'll have several outstate hearings to gather public input on the redistricting process. And the first hearing, you have received a notice on, I think a little over a week ago, confirming that we'll be going to Brainerd for the first outstate meeting. That'll be next Tuesday. We will have transportation provided for those who do wish to attend, and we'll make sure that we return as quickly as possible that evening, hopefully not arrive back home too late, around 10 o'clock. Expect as well, the following Tuesday, we'll proceed to take an outstate hearing to the Marshall area, I think is where we're headed right now, to Marshall. That would be the 13th. And then potentially one more outstate hearing on a site yet to be determined on the 21st. I'm sorry, the Tuesday, the 20th. And there would be potentially one other meeting on the 27th outstate as well. Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, do we have to notify the committee chair or the aide as to whether we're going or not?
Please, if you could let staff know, either Greg Pepin or committee legislative assistant, that would be great. Just so we can make sure that we're arranging for travel arrangements. Some members I know are going to drive and leave their car in one spot, for instance, and we can take care of all those arrangements for you if you plan on attending and returning. So, Representative Gray?
Mr. Chairman, just curious to know, what's the process for determining where our outstate, where our meetings will be in general? Is there some advice we should give you, or is this just something done by you and...
Well, and Representative Gray, I would be more than happy to talk with you if you have suggestions for outstate hearings. Right now, we're trying to pick various regional centers around the state that aren't too far for us to travel in terms of timing. I know the tax committee is taking some travels to outstate Minnesota, and some of those trips might be a little longer than we may want to go to Moorhead, for instance. So we're looking at potentially the Brainerd area, which is kind of near St. Cloud, and then head down to Marshall. And then, you know, probably the southeastern or northeastern corner of the state as well, potentially. But I'd be happy to talk with you about that if you have suggestions, Representative Gray.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to those communities here within the Twin Cities or within the metropolitan area that are interested in testifying, will there be a time for that, or are you anticipating that going locally as well as outstate?
Yeah. Representative Gray, at this point, I can say with certainty that we'll have hearings to at least invite them here, because we're in close proximity to their, you know, to their whereabouts in the Twin Cities area. Again, if our schedules permit, with session increasing in activity, with committee deadlines approaching, and we can work it out, we could potentially do some hearings around the metro area as well.
Thank you.
But that is a consideration, you know, as we get closer to committee deadlines, we have to kind of work within everyone's schedule. So, yeah, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, on a different subject, are we going to use adjusted or unadjusted numbers in our deliberation?
Representative Anderson, that's still an issue that has to be taken up and for discussion. And so, I mean, I have not made any determination, or I don't think any committee members have approached me in terms of which numbers would be used in terms of a final count.
Okay.
So,
are you going to announce it at some later date?
We'll have to look at, see how the process. To be honest, Representative Anderson, the numbers aren't here yet. And so, I mean, we really don't know. There may, in fact, be not much difference from what I'm hearing from some various sources. There may not be much difference between the two sets of numbers. And so it might not be an issue. Well, I think we'll have to wait and see. There's nothing else with us today. We have the state demographer present some background on the population shifts that occurred within the state. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gillespie. If you could please identify yourself and proceed. And members, if you're willing, Mr. Gillespie, you can take questions during the process, if that's okay with you.
It's at your discretion.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Planning Agency. And what I would like to do is to give a an overview of some of the census results that we have to date, really just one number. The sources of growth over the last decade, the basic reasons for why Minnesota has been growing. Third, look a bit at the distribution of growth around the state and what we believe to be its implications for redistricting. These are based on population estimates made both by my office and by the Census Bureau. Estimated changes in minority populations in the state. And then a brief review of some of the results from the 1990 census undercount analysis to see if that can inform us for possible adjusted or unadjusted numbers this time. First, a review of the census results to date. What we have right now is a total population of the state. Actually, there were three numbers. The first number is 4,919,479. That is the official resident population of Minnesota that is used for redistricting purposes. However, that is not the number that was used for apportionment, how many congressmen each state would have. That number is adjusted for overseas population with addresses, specific addresses in Minnesota. People who might be overseas population with addresses would be Minnesota citizens with an existing address in Minnesota who are temporarily serving at a post or a business overseas. That number, according to the Census Bureau, was 6,191, giving us a total apportionment count of 4,925,670, which was the number used to determine the number of congressional seats in Minnesota, which, as you know by now, we kept our eight congressional seats. The number, however, that this committee will be focusing on is that 4,919,479 total population.
Excuse me, Mr. Gillespie, I do believe we have a question. Oh. Representative Riffenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gillespie, could you explain to me why we use the one number for redistricting and the other number for apportionment purposes? It just seems like at one time you're counting that 6,000 people at one time and not at the other time.
Chairman, Representative Riffenberg, the overseas population has been adjusted, I believe, in the last three censuses to the to the total population. It hasn't always been the case that the federal government has done this adjustment for overseas population, but it is an adjustment that has been done for the last three times, I believe. The basic idea behind that is that these are citizens of the United States. They are citizens of specific states, and the argument was that they should be included in the total population, but because their home address within the state may be ambiguous, they would not be included for redistricting purposes. And I'm not sure if there was a legal citation to that effect, but that has been a convention for the last few censuses.
Representative Knobloch, follow-up to that?
It's really not a follow-up, Mr. Chair. It's a different question. I can wait until he's done with his presentation if you'd like me to do that.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Knobloch.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gillespie, can you tell us how close were we or are we to either losing a congressional seat or gaining a congressional seat with this population?
Chairman, Representative Knobloch, we were based upon forecast in the final as well as the final results, we were approximately 10 positions back from losing a congressional seat, which was a fairly safe position to be. I'm sorry, I can't remember offhand the states that are ahead of us. but I could certainly find that out for you if you wish. What's going to happen over the next 10 years is another question. There have been national pundits who have believed that Minnesota was going to lose a congressional seat each of the last three censuses, and we have not done so. We have maintained our eight. Perhaps the largest threat was during the 1980s when it appeared that Louisiana was going to pass us in population and gain a seat at our expense. That was an analysis done in the middle of the decade when we were coming out of a severe recession and Louisiana was growing very rapidly. Shortly thereafter, the oil industry took a nosedive. Louisiana began to slow down and ultimately lose slightly in its population, and we ended up with a decade with substantially more people as we do today. So there are a fixed number of congressional seats, and so it is a zero-sum game and we're not sure what those forecasts will look like in 10 years at this time.
Thank you. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gillespie, with congressional redistricting being a zero-sum game and being fixed at 435 seats, it could be logical to say that someone voting for statehood for Washington, D.C., which I think would gain three, would get three congressional seats, if I'm not mistaken. An argument could be made if a Minnesota congressman voted that way, and we're potential, at least in the 92 redistricting, from when I was told anecdotally, that any Minnesota congressman voting for statehood for Washington, D.C. was very likely taking a congressional seat away from the state of Minnesota and giving it to Washington. Would that follow through? Perhaps not in this cycle, but in the previous cycle?
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, that is clearly a possibility, and of course it would depend upon the population change that actually occurs over the decade. But I, you know, realistically, yes, it is a possibility. It would also depend on how the bill to grant Washington, D.C. was written. The number of congressional seats nationally has not always been fixed. There was historically an increase that occurred that has been fixed, and I can't remember exactly how many decades, but it has been at least, I believe, since World War II been fixed. But that also can change depending upon congressional action.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 1990s were a time of rather substantial growth in Minnesota. We increased by 12.4% over the decade, just slightly slower than the national rate of growth, but clearly faster than any of our neighbors in any of the other states in the upper Midwest or northeast portions of the United States. We also grew substantially faster than we did during the 70s and 80s, not quite as fast as we did during the 50s. However, the reasons for growth are substantially different. During the 50s, our growth was entirely due, really, to a large number of births, and despite the fact that we had a net outflow of people due to migration. This decade, the decade of the 90s, we had a net inflow of people due to migration, and migration was a substantial proportion of our total growth.
Sure. Representative Anderson.
Is this your handout?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, yes, sir.
Apportionment, don't we use the overseas population too?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, for apportionment to how many congressional seats, we do use the overseas population, but for redistricting, we don't.
The number here is wrong. 614, it should be 615.
Which slide are you on, Representative Anderson?
I'm on this.
Okay.
Page 2.
Page 3. Oh, 36,000.
Mr. Gillespie, I'll let you proceed. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have a calculator with me. My apology. I did round off to the nearest district. That does represent a change, an increase for House seats from 32,650, so approximately a 4,000 person increase in the average size of a House district for this decade. And as a result, members will have a larger population to represent. The sources of our population growth. Each year in Minnesota, approximately 60,000 babies are born, 30,000 people die, 80 to 90,000 people move in from other states, 70 to 80,000 people move out to other states, and 5 to 8,000 people immigrate from other countries. I raise these statistics for the simple idea that while the net effect is what we will be focusing on for population change and for redistricting purposes, the change, the total change in our society has been rather substantial, with somewhere between 800 and 900,000 new people coming to Minnesota over the decade. So that the actual total social change is fairly substantial. The net effect was an increase of 544,479, of which slightly over half was due to natural increase, the excess of births over deaths of 292,651, but nearly half was due to net migration, both international and domestic, an increase of 251,828 as a result of migration.
I believe that Representative Tinglestad has a question. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gillespie, I appreciate your good information here in the handouts. Unfortunately, I can't stay for the whole meeting. I'm double booked here. So I'm looking ahead at all the information, and I have a question on page 6. I'm in Anoka County, which looks like one of the fastest growing areas. I have a question specifically about my district. Do you have any information, or what can you tell me as far as the city of Andover and some of the growth in that area?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tinglestad, yes, we do make annual estimates of all cities and towns in the state. We have also made sort of rough estimates by legislative district, and those are both available, and I can get those to you by tomorrow.
Just to follow up,
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you. So with Anoka County being such a fast-growing area, and as far as I know, my city of Andover is probably one of the fastest-growing in Anoka County. I mean, would it show that probably that would be a high-growth area? And certainly I'll wait for your numbers, but from what you're aware of for that area?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tilsat, yes, I believe that is a very rapidly growing area.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Nearly half of our interstate migrants come from 5 states, most of which are surrounding states, but I do want to point out particularly California, Illinois, and Texas as a major source of migrants over the decade. The distribution of growth around the state and implications for redistricting. I have divided the state into 3 very large areas, one of which is simply Minneapolis and St. Paul cities themselves. The remainder of the 11 county metropolitan area, as is defined by the President's Office of Management and Budget, and then the remainder of the state. the growth was overwhelmingly, the largest proportion of the growth was overwhelmingly in the 11-county area surrounding Minneapolis and St. Paul, with an increase of approximately 18.5% based upon our estimates through 1999, that that we believe is slower than the growth that we saw during the 1980s, but still quite rapid. Perhaps the largest change that occurred over the decade was that remainder of the state, the rest of the state portion of the population, experienced some growth, approximately a little over 4% during the decade. Minneapolis and St. Paul continue to see modest declines in population. If we look around the state...
Sorry, Representative Seifert, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, just taking a look at the 11-county metro area, I'm familiar with the 7-county. I'm thinking Carver, Scott, Washington, Anoka, Ramsey, Hennepin, Dakota. To get up to 11, are we now adding Wright and Sherburne and who else? Chisago?
Representing Seifert, Chisago and Isanti in addition to Sherburne and Wright.
Okay, Isanti is the one that... Okay, thank you.
And that is the metropolitan area as is defined by the federal government for metropolitan statistical area, not including two counties in Wisconsin, which are also included in the federal definition. But we don't worry about them for redistricting. Over the state during the 1990s, most of the growth occurred in that what could be described as a donut around the Twin Cities metropolitan, around Minneapolis and St. Paul proper, but also substantial growth in the St. Cloud area, Rochester, and a corridor up through the central part of the state, including particularly the Brainerd and Bemidji areas up to the Canadian border. As well as the area around Alexandria and up towards Fergus Falls, also experienced strong growth. The a number of counties in southwestern and western Minnesota have experienced long-term population loss, and those are shown in red in this map. One of the distinguishing features in comparison to the 1980s is that the losses were at a much slower pace, and some of the counties and some of the communities in southwestern and western Minnesota actually saw turnarounds where they had been losing population for some period of time, have now experienced some gains in population. One county, Kuching, sort of stands out as a population loss area. I would offer some caution about interpretation of that, as a number of construction workers were counted in the population in the 1990 census. They were in Kuching County temporarily, working on a specific project, and after the project was completed, they left the county. And so the county does not really display a long-term population loss. It's that's more of an anomalous situation, although one that does have implications for redistricting purposes. The most rapidly growing counties in the state numerically were Dakota, followed by Washington, Anoka, Hennepin, and Scott. These are all fairly large metropolitan counties. The highest rates of growth were in Sherburne, again Scott County, Carver, Washington, and also Chisago. Sherburne increasing by a rate during from 1990 to 1999, an estimated rate of 51%. At the same time, we did see some counties decline in population. St. Louis County had the largest numeric decline, but that is a very large county in population, and as a result, proportionately, it's a much slower population loss than some of the other counties. Most of the counties declining in population or showing very, very slow growth are counties along the western edge of the state, and that is true of counties, particularly up in the extreme northwest and then in the west central portions of the state, counties such as Kitson in the extreme northwest and Big Stone in Lac qui Parle in the central along the central border of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of taking the statistics that you have from your map on page 5 along with your both boxes on page 6, actually, in that you're projecting the rest of the state, i.e. outside of the 11-county metro area, to lose 3 House seats. And I'm seeing that there seems to be the most acute loss seems to be, you know, statistics seem a little odd because from what I understand, you've got Lac qui Parle County losing 12.4% on page 6, but then on page 5, you've got Lac qui Parle red, which shows 0 to negative 7.8.
Yeah.
Is 7.8 the cap, or is it really that bad that it's 12.4?
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, thank you. I should have pointed that out. I am mixing estimates here. This is a comparison between the estimates that we make and the estimates that the Census Bureau makes. We are both showing substantial loss in Lac qui Parle County, but there is a difference in the total numeric loss. The numbers on this chart here are numbers from the Census Bureau. These are all estimates and will, of course, be superseded by the data that we receive.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gillespie, I think I'm the only person from the western half of the state who's on the redistricting committee, but you're generally, when you're projecting a loss of 3 seats in the rest of the state, quote-unquote, that general southwestern quadrant, if you were to cut Minnesota into 4 geographically roughly equal pieces, would they be losing, what, about a seat or a seat and a half, roughly? Assuming the worst-case scenarios are Lac qui Parle, it looks like Big Stone is the second worst, which is right next door to that. And I'm assuming that Traverse and Stevens probably and Chippewa aren't going to be real far behind on your list.
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, I haven't done the exact, or haven't tried to calculate the loss for the entire area, but that is a fairly substantial loss, population loss area. The area around Big Stone and Lac qui Parle, and also including Chippewa and surrounding counties, have long been an area of population loss, and many of the counties in that area reached their peak population in the 20s or 30s and have been declining ever since.
Mr. Gillespie, I'm just curious, can you explain exactly how the Census Bureau does these estimates on page 6, those figures? I know we're waiting for the exact numbers to come out, but how do they extrapolate the numbers for 99? And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Census Bureau uses information on births and deaths, to some degree school enrollment information and also building permit information, and builds that into a statistical model for making estimates. We use a similar model, however, and we also the Census Bureau estimates group quarters population. We actually call all of the group facilities, nursing homes, prisons, places like that, and contact them directly for their population. One other difference between our estimates and the Census Bureau estimates is that we do an actual local review where county officials and then subsequently city and township officials have an opportunity to review our estimates each year. And that review is not done for the Census Bureau, and of course the data that we will be receiving in March will be a good test. That's always a good test of comparison between how well our estimating methodology and the Census Bureau estimating methodology is working.
Sure.
Just in terms of the implied change in state House seats, based upon this population change and recognizing that, of course, the actual seats are drawn by the legislature, so that this is purely a hypothetical exercise. The shifts in population would imply a shift of approximately five state House seats into the 11 county area outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the source of those seats would be shared between Minneapolis and St. Paul and the remainder of the state. One thing I might remind you of is that the remainder of the state is substantially larger in population than Minneapolis and St. Paul, and so that's a much larger area as a source of House seats. That shift, we believe, is smaller than we saw during the 1980s, where the implied population shift was a shift of seven seats into the 11 county area outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, with five of those seats coming from the remainder of the state.
And Mr. Gillespie, what is the breakdown? If you had to compare the 11 county metro area on the numbers you have now compared with the rest of the outstate population, percentage-wise as a comparison, what would that be approximately?
The 11 county area is not quite half of the total population of the state. 11 county outside of Minneapolis, apart from Minneapolis and St. Paul, is not quite half of the total population. I can't remember the exact proportion for the remainder of the state, but the larger part of the remaining population is in that remainder of the state. Minneapolis and St. Paul have actually been declining in population for some time now, for several decades.
And is there a difference this year when you're looking at the 11 county metro area and the growth in representation potentially? 10 years ago, when you were the demographer, were you looking at the 7 county metro area in terms of the growth, or at that time as compared to now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the biggest change between now and 10 years ago was the addition of Sherburne County into the Twin City metropolitan area by the federal government. So that what we were looking at a decade ago was a 10 county area.
Okay. Representative Seifert, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By looking at your chart on the bottom of page 6, if we were to follow things, all things being equal and political gamesmanship kind of aside, generally by reading your chart, by looking at this cycle of redistricting, you're projecting what I would say three pairings in rural Minnesota and two pairings in Minneapolis-St. Paul, i.e. incumbents whose districts, because of population changes, unless you're going to draw squiggly tails into the suburbs somehow, not catching an incumbent as you squiggle your way through. Generally, you're projecting three pairings outside of the 11 county metro area and two within Minneapolis-St. Paul borders. Would that be correct,
Mr. Gillespie?
Chairman, Representative Seifert, the danger of showing something like that is that this is purely a hypothetical. Based upon total population shifts, and the actual lines are drawn by the legislature, and as you indicated, but the implication would be that there would be perhaps some sharing, some pairing of incumbents in some parts of the state. The map depicted here shows the same population estimates allocated to a legislative district, to a House district area for 1999. One caution is that these are based upon estimates for city and township population, so that for larger cities such as Minneapolis and St. Paul, we really don't have information to subdivide the cities. However, this does, I believe, give a very general impression of what you might be looking at when the data become available in March. The map shows a Twin City insert to the right, and the larger map is of the remainder of the state. A couple of features of that is that many of the districts shown in red have estimated variances that are below the minus 2% range. The darker reds would be districts that are more at variance from the average size district. Variance is greater than 10%, and these districts would need to grow larger to capture more people. The districts in blue are districts that have more population than the ideal size, the equal population size, and therefore would need to grow smaller. The districts between, the unshaded districts, particularly along roughly a corridor along Interstate 94, as well as in the cities in a generalized ring around the core cities, are districts that are roughly plus or minus 2% of the average district size. One of the challenges, of course, will be that population in redistricting will need to be pulled from the larger population areas, from the more rapidly growing areas into the remainder of the state to equalize the district size. So that while these districts appear right now to be roughly acceptable population size, the process of redistricting may also require some adjustments in those districts as well. Third, briefly, changes in minority populations. We have seen a very large increase in minority populations during the last decade. The Hispanic population grew by an estimated 72%, the Asian Pacific Islander population an estimated 66%, and the African American black population by 54%. The American Indian population a little bit slower, but still a robust 15%, substantially faster than the 6.2% estimated growth in the white non-Hispanic population. Most of that growth was concentrated in the Hennepin and Ramsey County areas, and I apologize, we do not have estimates by race and ethnicity below a county level, so I can't show Minneapolis and St. Paul separately. However, most of the growth, estimated growth, appeared in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. These are also counties where there are at least portions of the county, particularly in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where districts will need to grow larger in size, and these may be districts where there has been substantial change in population. We also, however, have seen increases in minority populations in other areas of the state, and we're anxiously awaiting the census data to tell us more about concentrations of population.
Mr. Gillespie, can I just ask a quick question? On the minority population slide, it was the green slide just a couple back, the Asian Pacific Islander category that's going to be identified with the census, is the Hmong population going to be broken out within the new categories that were offered by the census?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at the initial data that we received, no, it will not. We will only have the larger categories. Eventually, we'll be able to identify subcategories of population, such as Hmong, but initially, we will simply have a larger category.
And so, Mr. Gillespie, will there be a way to sort of identify in any way or capacity sort of where those, you know, that population lives? I know there's been an increased growth in that population, for instance, I think in the St. Paul area, I believe. Is there a way to, you know, focus on that or identify that? And if so, I mean, how do you know?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are three sources of information that we might use on this. One is simply the 1990 census, which is getting a little bit out of date, but can at least show where populations of particular languages or ethnicities were concentrating in 1990. Secondly is language spoken by children in school is measured by the school districts, and the information is available at a school level, not a school district, but a school level, and so that we can identify areas of concentration of children of specific languages. The third source of information would be community information, information from the communities of interest themselves.
Okay.
And then finally, census undercount. There has been much discussion of adjustment or not adjustment. Just to give a very brief history of the nature of or the origins of that discussion, the 1990 census had a total undercount nationwide of about 1.8%. The good news was that was the second most accurate census in history. The bad news was it was not as accurate as the 1980 census, which had an undercount rate of about 1.2%. President Bush Sr. Ordered and Congress concurred that the Census Bureau conduct an analysis and examination of two things. One is to how to conduct a census at a reduced price. The census is getting more expensive over time. And secondly, while achieving that lower price, to achieve an overall increase in accuracy as measured by a reduction in the overall undercount in the census. Various proposals have been made, and there has been a great deal of discussion regarding that, and we have the possibility of two data sets facing us as a result. In the 1990 census, Minnesota's undercount was 0.4%. We were the third lowest in the nation, tied with Iowa. Rhode Island had the lowest at 0.1%, followed by Pennsylvania at 0.3%. New Mexico was the highest at 3.1%, followed by Texas with 2.8%. Washington, D.C. had an undercount rate of 3.4%, but they, as you mentioned earlier, are not currently represented by congressional representation. Minnesota's undercount rates, estimated by the Census Bureau, varied substantially by race and ethnicity, with the highest rates in the black population at 4.8% and the American Indian population at 4.5%. These are relatively consistent with national rates. The rate for the Hispanic population was a bit lower than the national rate. The rate for the Asian Pacific Islander population was a bit higher than the national rate. Overall, for total minority populations, the rates were very similar to national rates. The conclusion is that the primary reason for Minnesota's relatively lower undercount rate in the 1990 census was our racial and ethnic mix, that basically we are a less diverse state than the nation as a whole, and that was the primary source of the difference. The range of undercount in Minnesota in 1990 was modest by national standards. 61 counties in Minnesota were undercounted, and had an adjustment been made, would have received a positive adjustment or an increase in population. 27 counties were overcounted and would have received a negative adjustment. That is one of the things that I think many people have not understood about the adjustment process, is that it's not simply adding people, it also can imply a decrease in population. Monoman County had the highest rate of undercount in 1990 at 2.5%, followed by Beltrami County at 1.9%. Aitkin, Chisago, and Kennebec were the most overcounted, proportionately overcounted counties in the state at a rate of 0.2%. Ramsey County had an undercount rate of 0.9%, and Hennepin had an undercount rate of 0.8%. Relatively modest by national standards, again lower than the national rate of 1.8%.
Representative Riffenberg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I was premature in wanting to ask my question, because I think some of it was answered in the data too, but my original question was if there was a breakdown between Leavenworth County Metro versus the outstate counties, which counties were undercounted and overcounted, because I was just wondering what the impact of undercounts were like in rural areas.
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riffenberg, we do have a listing of undercount and overcount rates by county and from the 1990 census, and can certainly make that available to you or to the committee as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
okay,
I'd appreciate that.
Representative Riffenberg, okay. Okay. Please proceed.
The last point that I would like to raise is that the definition of race and ethnicity is changing with this census, and there are substantial changes. The old definition was the definition that we used in the 1990 census, which included four basic racial categories: white, black, or African American, Asian and Pacific Islander, and American Indian, Eskimo, and Aleut. There was also the other race category. In 1990, most of the people who identified themselves in the other race category were Hispanic people. The primary reason that was determined by the Census Bureau for that was the placement of the questions, where race was asked first, and then Hispanic origin was asked as a later question. People would look at the race question, not see Hispanic ethnicity, and write in other race, and then get to the question on Hispanic ethnicity and write that in also. Basically underscoring that there's been a considerable amount of confusion over the difference between race and ethnicity, as has been defined by the President's Office of Management and Budget over the last three decades. The new definition, on the right side, this is a definition that is based upon the President's Office of Management and Budget revised circular on race and ethnicity definition. And this is the Department of Justice suggested guideline for the public law data release that you will be looking at. I underscore that is the current Department of Justice guideline that could change. But as we examine this right now, current definition is based upon OMB's revised definition, which perhaps the largest element of which was the division of the Asian and Pacific Islander into two categories, an Asian and a Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander category. So we will have a whole new racial category. And in addition, the addition of ability to check more than one racial category. For the first time in the history of the census, people will be able to identify under more than one race. The Department of Justice has suggested that in presenting information for this purpose, that where a person identifies themselves as white and some other race, that that person be included in the minority race category. So, if, for example, if a person were white and African American, they would be counted as African American. People who count themselves as two minority races, for example, African American and Asian, would be included in the other multiple race category. Again, this is the current Department of Justice guideline. Hispanic would continue to be an ethnicity category, and a Hispanic person may be of any race. The other race category will again be included, and one of the issues has long been that we're never quite sure who's going to check that. There's almost always some surprise in that, and we really won't know a great deal of detail on that for another year and a half or so. And with that, I conclude the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. I think we'll have a few questions. I did just want to ask real quickly, in order to comply with the Baker Carr case back in the 60s, the one person, one vote premise, I know the technology now allows us to go to a smaller deviation and focusing on where people live with the census blocks. Does the technology allow us to do that, to have a narrower deviation than we've had historically with the plus or minus 2% in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, certainly with the advent of computers, it is a great deal easier. There has also been a change in census geography that began in the 1990 census, that that all areas have the same geography. In the 80 census and before, the metropolitan areas had one geography, the non-metropolitan areas had another geography system, and it was extremely confusing, and we did not have block level information, for example, in non-metropolitan areas. So we now have a great deal more information in outside of the metropolitan areas, and that allows for a much greater, much closer analysis than ever before.
And given that technology and that ability, in your opinion, as in the demographer's office, do you see any pros or cons to having a narrower deviation using that technology offhand, or any problems?
Chairman, members of the committee, that as I think it's certainly easier or certainly possible to go to a lower overall variance because of the technology and the greater level of detail. Strategically, in the actual process doing the redistricting, problems, there are some issues that continue to arise regardless of the detail. For example, districts that span rivers where bridges become an issue and other acts of water, other access issues, areas where there's a substantial amount of water, the access to all parts of the district becomes an issue regardless of the level of detail of the data. As a result, it becomes a strategic issue that I think the committee is best prepared to answer. I'm not sure that there's any real fixed answer for that.
Yeah. Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gillespie, going back to the other race category, you identified in the 1990 census that people who were Hispanic that perhaps checked that box in error were the most frequent people identified in that box. Can you give us an example of the top three or four other races that most frequently checked that box or identified themselves as such?
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, in the 1980 census, The other race category expanded considerably, and in subsequent analysis, we identified that a substantial number of Hmong people identified themselves in the other race category. The reason being that the way the form was written, people were asked to check Asian and then a parentheses, for example, and the example included Chinese and Japanese and Filipino and a number of examples, Vietnamese and Thai and so on and so forth, a number of examples, but Hmong was not included in that. Recently immigrated people who were Hmong people had never really identified themselves as Asian before and didn't know where to check, and so there was a rise in that. The 1980 census also showed a substantial number of Hispanic people, again for the same reason that the 1990 census showed. The 2000 census, the questions have been reversed on Hispanic, so that the Hispanic question is asked first, are you Hispanic, yes or no, and followed by the question on race, and that in the test census, that has managed to greatly reduce the other race category to sort of a very, very miscellaneous kind of category. Some other people in the past who were multiracial had identified themselves also in the other race category, so that may also be a much smaller category. Hopefully that is not a large category, because it's not a very identifiable category. We really won't know who the other race people are until we get further data about a year and a half following this data release.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gillespie, it almost sounds like the goal is ideally to have no one fall in the other race category. Is that sort of the hope of the Census Bureau, so to speak?
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I think it's a very safe assumption. There is a subsequent data release that will come out, I would guess, around 2003, called the MARS data, the Modified Age, Sex, Race data, which is not adjusted data in the sense that we're talking about adjustment, but what it is data that's been corrected for things like the other race category, where other race people have been allocated to another more specific race, and that's one of the reasons why, when I show subsequent analysis, the other race category is not included. That has all been corrected for.
Thank you.
Question, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Gillespie. A couple of questions. Minnesota does relatively well compared to the, at least by these 1999 estimates. And these, I think it's important to remind ourselves as we look at this, so we're looking at 99 estimates. But Minnesota does relatively well compared to the rest of the country in terms of the undercount issue, particularly with communities of color. And yet, as also part of your presentation, we have a pretty concentrated, or at least we have some elements of concentration with communities of color. It's probably more perhaps with African Americans and blacks than it might be with, say, Hispanics, who can be found in, pretty widespread throughout the state. Is there, in your mind, is there a relationship between the concentration issue and the undercount issue in terms of amplifying its impact on a given legislative district?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, I believe most analysis has indicated historically that there is an impact of concentrations of population. One of the uncertainties, of course, is that each census is different. And one of the things that we are dealing with is that more people were counted in Minnesota and nationally than anyone had expected. And part of the reason for that could have been an improved quality of the census. That's one possible reason. I'm hoping that is the reason. But historically, yes, there has been some impact of concentration of population on undercount rates.
Well,
Representative Mariani.
Chair, Mr. Gillespie, to me it's sort of just common sense that if we know that there are communities that are, you know, that have a higher rate of undercount than the whole, and if those communities are then the characteristics of those communities then are concentrated geographically, then the impact per that geographic area, in my mind, common sense would say that there is a correlation. And so, I mentioned, Mr. Chair, because I think it's important for us in Minnesota to be real sensitive to this issue, because we do have small communities of color relative to the entire state. We're not a California or a Texas or Florida. It could be easy for us to dismiss the issue of the undercount in the macro, but it seems to me that in the micro, when we get right down to these, you know, precincts and legislative districts, it might be a bigger issue than what the macro might suggest.
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, yes, in historically there has been an association, and that association has been most concentrated in areas where there has been relatively high concentrations of people of color combined with the relatively high poverty rate. Right.
Mr. Chair, one
Representative Mariani.
Question. And I understand that every census is different, and I too have heard that that this one counted more people and was much more, we sort of learn, you know, we've gotten better at doing this. But what's the, you know, and not to, well, what's your guess in terms of what's the difference going to be between the 99 estimate and what the census is going to tell us? Is it going to be markedly different? Are you feeling fairly confident that what you presented today will be pretty much, at least in the macro, where things are going to be? Or what's been the history between estimates and the eventual census numbers?
Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, one of the uncertainties that I'm operating with right now is I still don't know, in fact, nobody really knows yet, why the census counted more people than they had expected or than anybody had expected. I believe that there are three general possibilities. One is that the census was a much higher quality census than previously thought possible, and that there is relatively little undercount. A second possibility is that there's substantially more immigration than anybody was aware of, and that a substantial number of recent immigrants filled out the census form, which is also a possibility. A third possibility is that the Census Bureau may have done much more double counting than they have in previous censuses. One of the changes in the census form that was a last minute change was the dropping of a small item at the top of the census form that in previous censuses that it asked whether or not this is your usual place of residence. Is this where you normally live? If no, where do you normally live? People in Minnesota who were temporarily in other states, and remember this is in April, people who were, for example, in Arizona in previous censuses would have checked that top portion and said, well, my usual place of residence is in Minnesota. And when the Census Bureau did their analysis, were able to pull these out. That question was dropped, the census, to simplify the form. And I think there's some ambiguity as to where people will be counted. That is also a possibility. The difficulty is that the relatively larger count, the larger than was expected, occurred in virtually every corner of the country, in states that would have been states that people might have been at temporarily, the Arizonas and the Floridas and the Texases, as well as places like Minnesota and Michigan and Wisconsin, where people would have come from. So relatively larger count seemed to have occurred in virtually every area of the state of the nation, and I think one of the things that I'm keenly interested in watching for is any analysis of why that happened, and we haven't heard anything yet.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, this will be the last question. I always enjoy talking to Mr. Gillespie, and usually I wind up asking more questions than I intended to in the outset. But I represent parts of St. Paul, and what I know about my community is that we have a lot of duplexes, triplexes, quads that really technically aren't duplexes, triplexes, and quads. And I'm not sure that if I were to go down to City Hall or at the county, wherever they keep the records of the real estate characteristics, that they would show up there. I just know that because I live there, and I see little homes that have triplexes in them, and can't figure out how they do that. Does the census factor that in? Obviously, if they're mailing something and it doesn't show up as a triplex, they're probably only going to send one, like a household thing. Does the census factor that in, knowing that characteristics of cities? Because I don't think St. Paul's unique in that way. And if so, does that get factored in when they do the adjusted? Is that where you would look for that factoring, when they give you the adjusted numbers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, the census, and I'll have to go back into history again, back to the 1990 census, where communities were asked to conduct a local review to check the Census Bureau's housing unit counts. In many areas, the Census Bureau had a higher count of housing units than the local community had. In this census, the Census Bureau purchased virtually every commercial and non-commercial mailing list available and merged them together. Yes, Publishers Clearing House was one of the ones that they purchased, as well as many other databases. And as an initial listing, and then sent teams of census workers starting in 1998 into the field to double check addresses and to try to identify places where there may be addresses that hadn't been previously caught, and they were directed to specific types of areas that had already been pre-identified as areas where there might be some difference between official counts of housing units and actual places where people live. Newly emerging areas, new communities, temporary residences, mobile home parks, places where there is a substantial number of rental properties and duplexes and triplexes and places like that around universities and colleges are always an area, places where there may be basement conversions, things like that. And the attempt was to identify all of those housing units where people might live. Now, the question is, did they get all of them? Probably not. But again, they're building upon information that they had in the 90 census that was double-checked by local communities and have built on that. That's probably not the main source of undercount. Undercount has historically been more linked to confusions over who is in a household. An example might be transitional families where there may be, where a child may be between a divorced mom and dad, and neither one of them counts the child. Questions over persons temporarily residing in a place, areas where situations where the respondent did not want to identify a person that was living in an area within the household for a variety of reasons. There are a number of reasons that have been indicated as to why undercounts might occur. Missing housing units is one possibility, but I don't believe it's the largest possibility. I think there's been substantial effort to try to identify all places where people might live.
Mr. Gillespie, quickly, I just want to go back to one of the questions I asked earlier. You said that in the 11-county metro area, excluding Minneapolis and St. Paul, that was a little less than half the state's population. If Minneapolis and St. Paul was included in the entire 11-county metropolitan area, what would the percentage breakdown be?
Chairman, members,
metro outstate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the, if you include Minneapolis and St. Paul in the 11-county area, it would be more than half of the total population. I can get those specific splits to you,
okay.
If that's okay.
There's no other further questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Mariani.
Either to you or to Mr. Gillespie, when do we expect to have the actual numbers to start working with?
Well, Mr. Gillespie can probably respond quickly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, we expect to have that in the middle to end of March. I don't expect it right now at the beginning of March, but I would expect it any time from the middle to the end of March.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. It's all right. I think we're just going to move on to have Kelly Knight from House Administration Services come forward before we have Lee Millier come up. I asked her to come forward just to make sure that she could provide us what the timeline was of all the caucus GIS folks that were hired for the various caucuses and let everybody know what the timeline was, what the hiring process was. And members, the reason I did this was because I wanted to put this on the record to show, in fact, that there has been equality in having this process for all caucuses, because my understanding is that 10 years ago this was not the case. And so with that, Ms. Knight, welcome to the committee, and if you could just share a little bit of background information in terms of the timeline and the hiring processes, that would be helpful for the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, both caucuses posted their redistricting positions from the time period of October 13th, with them closing on October 26th of the year 2000. They both posted in the local area newspapers, as well as we posted on a GIS website that had been recommended to us. Interviews for the positions were conducted during the months of November and December, and all staff for both caucuses, everyone was on board and actually started by January 8th. And each of the caucuses, as far as redistricting personnel, the makeup is they all have one redistricting analyst and a redistricting technician.
Any questions from members? Representative Abrams.
Chairman, I would just like to add that the redistricting subcommittee of the LCC, and I think the only two who have kind of been the holdovers during the 10-year period were myself and Senator Pogemiller, made certain that all four caucuses had identical equipment. Frankly, the equipment that we received was, I think, almost verbatim a recommendation from the nonpartisan staff led by Mr. Mueller, and I believe, at least by anecdotes, that all the equipment was delivered roughly within a few days of each other and were set up within a few days of each other. And I think that that's kind of an important component, too, that all four caucuses, I think, partially out of the experience in 1991, everybody who recycled through GIS felt very strongly that everybody have identical equipment at an identical time and identical access to the subcommittee's office and the subcommittee staff.
Representative Engelstad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're talking about staff and equipment, I haven't seen any numbers yet, and I don't know if you have them or if they're available. I'm just wondering, what does the state, what's the state cost every 10 years to do a redistricting program like this, and how is it budgeted as far as kind of a unique item that's only handled once every 10 years?
Actually, Representative Abrams may be able to answer that question from the GIS.
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Tingelstad, during the interim, the GIS office remains in operation and has, I believe, three employees, is it, Mr. Mueller, during the period. They have lots to keep them busy in a whole range of activities dealing with census information, demographic information, school funding information they were used for. Additionally, the GIS staff has been instructed on a bipartisan, bicameral basis to work closely with state planning. If we have some capabilities here that are not at state planning, they are to cooperate, and also with the Metropolitan Council and other local units of government. And I believe that maybe more in the early to mid-90s rather than the late 90s, you had some of those requests, as I recall. The annual budget of the office between redistrictings is in the $150,000 to $200,000 range, as I recall. And that includes some software updates because additional information becomes available from the census and other official sources literally on a monthly basis, and we want to keep the database up to date. Every 10 years, we have an equipment purchase that is necessary to do redistricting so that the four caucuses would have equipment. I really forget what the total number was. It was several hundred thousand dollars. It was a lot less than it was 10 years ago, simply because you can buy a whole lot more computing power, and in particular, printers and plotters that work as opposed to 10 years ago. So that not only do all four caucuses have access to the information, but I believe that planning also, I don't know if they're part of the network or not, but they certainly were part of the consultative process as to what was necessary so that everybody would have the same equipment and be had access to the same data. Additionally, in addition to the software that was purchased and the hardware, Mr. Mueller and his staff has loaded on the network a whole range of demographic, election, geographic boundaries, and other information that will not be available in the census. I do not mean to speak for the other three members of the GIS, but the feeling that was expressed at the meetings were we would rather have a overabundance of information that would be publicly available rather than an underabundance in how people want to use the different information and results and lines and whatever is their business, not ours. But we've tried to have probably the most open access to information in the country through this process and equality among the four caucuses.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Knight. Representative Anderson, do you have a question? Do we
know what the governor's task force has got for staff?
Well, Representative Anderson, we can ask someone from the governor's staff to come forward, but currently we may have a good segue from Representative Abrams' comments with Lee Millier. You can go right into just giving us a little bit of background on what has been provided each of the caucuses, both in terms of hardware and software, which may be helpful for everyone. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Millier, if you could just identify yourself for the tape when you get set up.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Lee Millier. I'm the director of the LCC GIS office. And if you excuse me, I'm going to set up here.
Representative Mariani.
Sure. Mr. Meal, I always meant to
rhymes myself. With familiar.
Familiar. Yeah. Mr. Familiar.
Mr.
Millier. While he gets ready, I'm just wondering, have there been any talks about the feasibility of making this technology, and perhaps this might be a question to Representative Abrams, has there been any talks anywhere about the feasibility of making this technology available to the general public through, say, libraries or public outlets so that interested citizens, could also weigh in, either manipulating the data or trying to understand better what we're trying to do here?
And Representative Abrams can comment on that. I do know that the governor's task force has made comments about trying to make that information available to the public in some way as well. But Representative Abrams?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, the Mr. Mueller will be talking about, I always blow your name, Lee, after 10 years, you and Sue Dosal from the Supreme Court, I always call her Sue Dosal, but that's neither here nor there. Mr. Mueller will be discussing the website, which will have information available to the public that is supported by a variety of platforms, ArcViewMapInfo, ArcInfo, and Atlas. So you don't have to get the same redistricting software that the four caucuses have. The difficulty we would have in setting up a workstation for the public, however you define the public, is that that would take time and effort to be able to support that workstation from users who would not be familiar with the software. So you have kind of a dichotomy of we're making all the information available, but in order to make the people available, you are going to have to incur a rather significant expense of expanding the staff of the GIS in order to do that. So at least the initial thought, and it certainly isn't the final thought, but the initial thought is that the software is relatively intuitive, relatively easy to use, and the knowledge is out there with all sorts of help menus by the bushel full. That we think that with a little bit of elbow grease and effort that members of the public who are really interested in manipulating the data would have the opportunity. But one of the reasons for the website and all the information being on the website is to have that that public component.
Please proceed, Mr. Millier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm prepared to discuss four major issues regarding Minnesota redistricting. I'm going to discuss software, hardware, data, and our website. Software. The software that we use is Geographic Information System software. And I'm just going to read to you a textbook definition of what GIS is. It's a computer-based tool for mapping and analyzing things that exist and events that happen on Earth. GIS technology integrates common database operations such as query and statistical analysis with a unique visualization and geographic analysis offered by maps. Common GIS applications include E911 routing systems or address matching. It's a common technology used today on the internet. I'm sure most of you have used things like MapQuest to find locations or directions. Environmental monitoring, meteorology uses satellite systems, remote sensing, aerial photography. Parcel-based permitting, which the metro area is getting a lot more involved in. You're seeing parcel databases growing at a fairly rapid pace. And, of course, redistricting. The software we chose is Maptitude for redistricting. We evaluated four different redistricting software packages. We looked at Maptitude, a piece called AutoBound. It's an extension that works with ArcView software. We looked at a freeware package provided by ESRI. They're the major maker of GIS software. And we also looked at something called MapObjects, where we would write our own package, much like the states of Florida and Texas did. And for those of you who are in Dallas, that was the software that we used when we were doing our simulations. The Maptitude for redistricting will also support a variety of other GIS packages, including ArcView, MapInfo, ArcInfo, Atlas, and other packages. I've had a lot of questions regarding this, and we have tested it thoroughly. It works well with ArcView, which is probably the most commonly used GIS package in the state. I'm going to move on to hardware now. Each caucus received a Dell Precision 420 workstation. The specs are a 1 gigahertz processor, 1 gigabyte of memory, a DVD drive, CD read-write, 4 millimeter tape backup, and a 40 gigabyte hard drive. These were all purchased on October 5th, and they were all installed by January of 2001.
I've been in there, but
printers. Each caucus received three printers. You received an HP DesignJet 5000 plotter. Advice to the caucuses: if you need a map really fast, do not use the 1200 DPI printing. It makes really attractive maps, but it'll print very slowly. And if you need a map quickly, you should use draft mode. An HP 8150 LaserJet printer, it's a very fast printer for printing reports, and a Epson 1520 color printer, which is a smaller color printer that will do up to 17 by 22 color prints. Each caucus received a variety of accessories. They received a Panasonic projector, just a basically a high resolution projector. It's portable, so you can take these to meetings and view plans or use these as you wish. Uninterruptible power supply, which just basically prevents the workstations from crashing during a brownout or loss of electricity. And map racks for storing and organizing your maps. The data that we'll be using for redistricting are the Census Bureau Tiger line files. Tiger is an acronym for topologically integrated geographically encoded reference line files. Basically, what that means is it's all of the visible physical features in the state are coded in these line files, and we are able to extract all of these different features using the GIS software into the building blocks of redistricting. And the building blocks are listed here: the census block, census tracts, precincts, MCDs, which are cities, townships, and unorganized areas, counties, and, of course, legislative and congressional district boundaries.
Representative Abrams?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mueller, for some reason in the deep recesses of my memory, I thought school district boundaries were also included. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Milliard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, yes, you are correct. There is a host of other databases contained within TIGER. I did not list them all. If you wish, I can provide you with a comprehensive list.
I would be afraid to ask you for because it ends up being a 20-page report. So.
For redistricting, we also will be using the race data or the PL94-171 data. The race, what you see listed here are the individual race categories. The 63 categories are the combinations of the of these races, the possible combinations of these races, and there can be up to 512 different races if we are to get two counts. This is a basically an explanation of how the races can be broken down into more simple fields so that we can aggregate all the different races and have all the racial groups add up to 100%. We've also included all of the election results data from 1992 through 2000. And we've included all the races listed, presidential, U.S. Senate, U.S. House of Representatives, governor, legislative, secretary of state, attorney general, auditor, and treasurer. The election results were disaggregated down to the block level. Disaggregation is redistributing the election data down to the census blocks proportionally based on voting age population percentages. Basically, what that means is you have an election race. You divide that by the voting age population of a precinct, and you multiply that by the block level voting age population, and what that gives you is block level election results. Incumbent databases. I'm sure everyone here has received a map of where we think or our databases think you live. It's known as a process called geocoding, and we basically took a database of your names, addresses, zip code, city, plug them into our software, and it creates a map layer of points of where everybody lives. And this data will be used to to ensure that members live within their districts. On our website, we will provide data for download for redistricting purposes. The data will be provided in Caliper format, which is the Maptitude software format, and also in something called Shapefile format, which runs with ArcView. We also plan on posting plans on the web for browsing purposes. There will be maps and reports and a variety of information. Just a little plug for our website. Right now, we have information on redistricting law and technology. We have plenty of maps and data available, and the address and an email address if you wish to contact us.
Thank you, Mayor. Mr. Miller, are there any questions? I just have one question I'll follow up by asking Mr. Gillespie. But the technology, as he stated, allows us to basically proceed with a small deviation, population deviation, in order to comply with the one person, one vote. Do you Do you see that being possible as well, going to a small deviation? And any comments on the pros or cons from a technology standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is more possible, but the one risk that I think of is the principle that we are considering adopting, which is splits of political subdivisions. Those would probably increase with the need to decrease the deviation.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Millier. Appreciate it. There's no other testimony, no other questions? No? If not, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and then I have a question if you're getting ready to adjourn. Question for Mr. Millier. I did it. You know, one of the things I learned in Dallas when we went through simulation, of course, that was a different software program that we used down there. But one of the things that I learned in terms of just the practical stuff was that it was really important to pay attention to the data and not get seduced by the pictures. And we saw what we thought was a glitch with the Florida system, where they use these colored, we were doing the Dade County area, and they use these different colors. And sometimes the color would kind of wrap itself around, and it was really confusing to us whether or not that meant that was part of the district or not. I don't know if Maptitude has those kind of problems or not, but I think it's important for us because pictures tend to be so much more powerful, in terms of conveying a message, that we not get seduced by it and always stay focused on the numbers themselves, the data as it's presented in data format. I don't know if Maptitude has those problems or if you share the same kind of thoughts.
Mr. Millier?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, the Florida redistricting system did not allow you to customize colors in your plans.
Okay.
You were basically locked into a palette with their plans. With Maptitude, we will have control of creating any type of color palette we wish, and no, we should not experience those types of problems.
Sounds like we have a superior plan, Mr. Chair, in Florida.
The GIS subcommittee has done a fantastic job. We've been in good hands with Representative Abrams.
Chairman, one of the things about Maptitude, which I found fascinating, is that when they originally came up with it, and Lee will correct me if I'm wrong, they were charging like $599 for it. And they had problems selling it because people did not believe that you could get this powerful program that would work for $599, and they kept on raising the price so that they can get some states to buy the program. And it is true that they've made some enhancements, Mr. Mueller, but the fact is that this is literally the same piece of software that that they were hawking back in 1997 for $599. Wow. And now cost what, I believe, $19.99 is what they're up to.
Tomorrow is buy low.
And it worked.
Yep. First time.
Anything else, Representative Mariani?
Well, I have a chair about Mr. Chair, I have a question about our next meeting, but I didn't want to upstage you. And you're probably going to announce the February 13th.
In fact, I think you just came in right after we made some announcements on that. As we mentioned earlier, we'll be taking the next Tuesday's meeting to Brainerd, gathering outstate testimony. Should have had a notice on that a little over a week ago, as well as when we announced that previously we'd be taking outstate hearings. The following Tuesday, we'll be going to Marshall and two yet undetermined sites potentially for other outstate travel.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question. I think it's great that we're doing this, and I'd like to see us, if possible, do even more of that. I think it's really important for the people of the state of Minnesota to feel ownership over this process. It's probably one of the areas where we draw some of the most cynical responses from the public in terms of what goes on, although that's probably dictated by the fact that we always wind up in court because there's plenty of people out there that are wanting to weigh in and circumvent the legislative process. But my question, I guess, to you, Mr. Chair, is in Brainerd and Marshall are wonderful places. Is there a rhyme and a reason why we're going to Brainerd or Marshall? Is the chair open to suggestions about other places that we can go?
And as we discussed with Representative Gray, asking the same question.
Mr. Gray was here earlier. Today.
Yeah, he was here. We discussed earlier, I mean, we're trying to basically arrange our travel to different regional centers in the state, keeping conscious travel schedules to arrange for members to attend these meetings. And so we've kind of picked the Northeast, Northwest, the Northwest and Southwest corners of the state, going to them right now, as well as potentially the North, somewhere in the Northeast, perhaps, or the Southeast corners. But I'm open to discussing with you if you have suggestions for arranging meetings. As we get closer to committee deadlines, it becomes tougher for scheduling purposes. I know other committees as well are doing traveling arrangements. The Tax Committee is taking several outstate hearings around the state. And so we need to be conscious of members' schedules as well. And Representative Gray asked if we'd be doing any metropolitan area hearings. That's certainly a possibility. We may have those hearings here on a weeknight or during a regular committee schedule, but certainly open to talking with you about that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have some recommendations for you.
And if members could just let either staff, Eric Holmstrom or Greg Pepa, know if you plan on attending, so just so we can make those arrangements, it would help us very much. If there's nothing else, meeting is adjourned.